you want. Yeah.
Sitting in my head, like, my big headphones on, obviously, like, trying to focus. She's, like, talking at me, and I, like, I can hear her, but I'm just, like, ignoring her. But after, like, 5 minutes of her talking at me, like I pull my headphones down and, like...
Okay, it's 8:34, so I think we should get started. Apparently my computer's too new. It's quite old already, I don't know. But so I'm sorry we have to get a late start. There's one video on there that I really like to show you, but it's at the second half of the talk, so I think I'll be able to... We'll make it work.
Yeah, we'll make it work.
My name is Esther DuPont. I'm in the College of Health Sciences. I'm professor of physical therapy there, so that's where I live. These are the best ways to reach me, in order of best ways to reach me. So email is the absolute best way to reach me, unless you can find me in my office. Okay, but that's the second best way. Phone is... Quite often when I'm in my office, I don't even pick up the phone because I'm with somebody. So emailing is really the best way if you need to reach me. If you want to come talk to me, that's fine. If you can find me in my office and there's nobody in there, my door's open, so you can come in and stuff like that. So we're going to talk today about muscle atrophy. So anybody, atrophy, do we know what muscle atrophy is? Everybody kind of has an idea, right? Anybody, other words for muscle atrophy that you've heard?
Wasting.
Muscle wasting.
Sarcopenia.
Cachexia.
Cancer, right?
Yeah.
Anything else? So muscle atrophy, wasting of muscle. Your muscle gets smaller. How does that happen? So what I'm going to do today, I assume you read the chapter in the book. Okay, that's what I'm going to assume. It's quite good in the sense that it talks a lot about what some of the causes are of muscle atrophy. It goes into a lot of depth about denervation, spinal cord injury, things that change in muscle fiber type. So I'm actually not going to talk about the things that are in the book, because you can read that, and it's written quite well. It has some really nice clinical correlates in there, some patient cases and things like that. So I'm going to mainly talk about some of the particularly signaling pathways that occur in muscle itself, and then I'm going to show you some examples of what we have done in the lab to investigate those. Okay, so that's what I'm really going to do. I assume you read the book, because it's a good read. And it's, you got it? You got two?
Because let's compute now.
Yeah. So I got started with some videos at a little bit. Thanks, then. So I heard sarcopenia. Cachexia. Anybody heard of dynopenia? Anybody care to guess what that would be? Loss of strength. Okay, so let's get into that. Frailty. I didn't hear that. Which is probably good, because it's not necessarily muscle atrophy. And so let's go into that, because I think it's important to get these terms straight. Particularly because right now in the clinic, in my opinion, they're not used correctly all the time. And I think it's important, particularly now, if you go in a clinic, if people call things sarcopenia that are not really sarcopenia, there's not a lot I can do about it. You can educate them about it. But let's go over really what the definitions are. So what is muscle atrophy? Decrease in the mass of muscle. Very simple. It can be due to a lot of different things. I've just mentioned a couple here that are like all encompassing. Disuse, disease, aging, malnutrition. All of those things can cause and will cause muscle atrophy. Now, as you can see here, This is just one leg compared to the other leg. So that's probably not aging or malnutrition, because that happens in the whole body. This is likely due to something like
immunization.
They will be. They will be. I'm sorry. We should have put
it. No, it's okay. I just want to make sure.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. So this is probably not due to malnutrition or aging. It probably is something like denervation that affects only one side. So sarcopenia, this is a term that is misused the most clinically. People now use sarcopenia for any type of muscle atrophy clinically. You can see it associated with liver transplants. You see it associated with even ICU use. People use the word sarcopenia. Sarcopenia really is defined as age-associated loss of skeletal muscle mass and strength. And the reason I think it's important to look at that is because the underlying mechanisms are different. Quite often we know a lot more about clinically what happens if people lose muscle mass than we know with aging. And particularly, if you would dive into the literature and you're going to look at just gene expression profiles, okay? So you're just going to look at what genes change with aging in muscle or after a liver transplant with muscle. They're completely different, so they're not the same thing. And I think that's really important to remember, because what you're going to do as an intervention will be different if the underlying mechanisms are different. So this was coined by Rosenberg. Bill Evans actually is the one who quite often thinks that he coined it, but if you really go back into the literature, this is where it was first seen in the literature. It's literally called poverty of flesh, and it's the age-associated loss of skeletal muscle mass and strength. So sarcopenia is really multidimensional. There's a lot of reasons, or there could be a lot of reasons, and people are looking into this in a lot of detail. Decrease in activity, nutrition, motor neuron decrease. All of this happens, and all of it contributes to sarcopenia. Whether one is more important than the other is probably depends upon the person, too. So cachexia, weakness and wasting of the body due to severe chronic illness, an unintended loss of 5% or more of body weight in 12 months, and loss of strength. That's kind of the definition of cachexia. Quite often with what Emily mentioned, cancer cachexia, that 5% actually occurs much faster than within 12 months. And cachexia quite often occurs with cancer, cardiac disease, kidney disease, COPD, and it has different underlying mechanisms than sarcopenia. So it's usually associated with a lot higher inflammatory environment than traditional sarcopenia is, or muscle wasting due to denervation, or a muscle wasting due to spinal injury. So the treatment of cachexia is likely going to be very different. So dynapenia is a term that was coined not even that long ago. I don't know, Davis, if you had heard about it. Right, because I do think it's more associated with frailty than just sarcopenia. And you can see here, there's a lot of things that kind of feed into dynapenia. So there's even things like cognitive function with a question mark. Does that feed in to the age-associated loss of power and force? So I don't expect you to know all of these parameters, but you can see here sarcopenia really is only part of this dynapenia. So the loss of muscle mass and strength is only part of why strength, power, and force decreases. And I think that's important to realize, too, that the two are disconnected. And yeah, this is from 2012, from about 5 years ago, and so, you know, it probably was coined a couple of years before that. But really with the realization that there is something a lot more ongoing than just sarcopenia. And I think clinically that's really important too. So what is frailty then? So frailty is really a clinical term. It's a recognizable state of increased vulnerability. And so that's a lot more vague, right? How do you measure that? So there are resulting from HSO-TTA decline in reserve and function across multiple physiological systems. But frailty is used not only for age-related frailty. There are a lot of frailty indices for people with cardiac disease, people with lung disease. And so there's a lot more that goes into frailty than only muscle-related issues. And so this is by Fried, which there's lots of these, what's called frailty cycles. This is just one of them. But strength and power, walking speed, total energy expenditure, neuroendocrine dysregulation, a lot of this comes into play, disease comes into play when you talk about frailty. Any questions up till here? So those are really some definitions that I wanted to get out of the way because I think they're used interchangeably and it's important to kind of realize what we're talking about when we talk about muscle atrophy. So muscle atrophy is, I use it a lot because it's kind of all-encompassing. Except for the fact that it quite often doesn't talk about the loss of strength necessarily. It's more the loss of muscle mass itself. So keep that in mind. That strength and muscle mass are not don't necessarily go hand in hand all the time. How do we study muscle atrophy? So there's disuse atrophy in humans, bed rest and unilateral lower limb suspension are used to experimentally study muscle atrophy, what happens. And you can do that, of course, in younger people, older people, and look at the effect of aging on top of disuse. In an animal model, these are the most used animal models. There are more, but you can do an immobilization, which you can do by casting or stapling. I have to spell this 20 times before it still doesn't make sense. What it is, I don't particularly like the model, but people are using it because it's easy. You put a big staple and staple the leg like this, and so you get this use in this leg. I don't particularly care for it, but we use hind limb suspension a lot, which I don't particularly care for either. It has its problems too, and I'll show you a picture. But it mimics much better what is seen in humans with bed rest and space flight. Denervation, spinal cord injury are good models for muscle disuse if you want to study denervation and spinal cord injury because they're not exactly the same as, for example, bed rest or hand suspension. Botox is nice because it's reversible, so you can inject Botox and you can see how the recovery of muscle mass may occur over a long period of time. So that's why Botox can be used. And so this Botox is similar, of course, to denervation, except for the fact that it's reversible, and denervation is not. Unless you get into regenerative medicine, and then you could regenerate maybe a nerve. I went to a meeting last week about regenerative rehabilitation, and they are regenerating nerves, but it's a slow going process. So some of the interventions that people use to study this use is resistance exercise. Bicycling, which is more of an aerobic exercise with more resistance than you can have with running sometimes. So you can add resistance to it. So that might be a combination. For the animal models, intermittent reloading or reloading. So if your hind limb suspend an animal or if you staple an animal, you can unstaple it or let it load again. And I'll go into that in a little bit. To study recovery, which is something I'm really very interested in. I'm really interested in recovery of muscle atrophy. Or inhibiting muscle atrophy, which we've been doing for the last couple of years. Doug Butterfield and I have a grant looking at the effect of massage, how that could affect muscle size. And if you want, you can go online in our paper, just got published last week, with references that are incorrect, that we still have to correct. Which we found out last night. Very nice. So we have to... They are correct to a certain extent, but in the methods, they're not correct. So we have to correct that. We'll do that today or tomorrow. You've seen this slide. So Dr. McCarthy talked about muscle hypertrophy, and he actually went in quite a bit about muscle size regulation in general, correct? So he talked some about muscle atrophy already, too. And I know he went into myostatin, and so I'm not going to cover that. Because he did. If you have any more questions about it, we can go into it. But I think he, from looking at his slides, he covered that well. So really, when you get into muscle atrophy, this protein balance in skeletal muscle is off. And it's off going towards the catabolic side. And so Dr. McCarthy talked mainly about the anabolic side and what happens on this side. And so I'm going to talk more about what happens on the atrophy side. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of the first half here. I'm going to talk about some of the mechanisms that are not mentioned in, like I said, not mentioned in the book, but I think are going to be important because I think a lot of the drugs that are going to be developed or people are going to try to develop are going to have to do with signaling pathways and with molecules that are present in the body, and they're not necessarily mentioned in the book as much. So with atrophy, really there's a decrease in protein synthesis and an increase in protein degradation, which tips this balance to the catabolic side. You've seen this, right? This is not new. So what happens with atrophy is you get a decrease in synthesis. So really, in this really these really small letters here, you have protein synthesis. So all of this, and here's your myostatin, all of these things lead down to, you know, AKT is very important. I assume Dr. McCarthy talked about that too. It's a pivotal protein in the regulation of muscle mass. And it does so by both affecting the protein synthesis side of your balance, as well as the protein degradation side. So we're going to talk about the protein degradation side a little bit more. What this picture does not show is what I think is really important for some of the things that we have lately started getting more and more interested in. It's actually the fact, it really only talks about how IGF-1 and the IGF-1 pathway affects AKT signaling protein synthesis. What it doesn't talk about is this side, and there are more proteins, a lot more proteins involved in this, but in the mechanical signaling side. So how does the muscle know that it's actually being used? What if you wouldn't have IGF-1 increases? And you still have this, and so that's one of the things we do with massage. We massage the muscle. There's no change in IGF-1 necessarily, which we have measured. But there are changes in the cell membrane because you push on it. And that's partly what happens with resistance exercise too. There's the mechanical signaling as well as the anabolic hormonal signaling. And so through this mechanical signaling, you also affect mTOR, and in this case, focal adhesion kinase, which is sitting at the cell membrane and senses stress, actually bypasses AKT, which is important because then you could have actually things that signal through your IGF-1 pathway add to what happens here. And sometimes that happens and sometimes it doesn't. Okay? And so this would increase protein synthesis and cell growth. So what we talk about today a lot more than synthesis, because you've covered that quite a bit, is degradation. So these are the main degradation pathways. The ubiquitin proteasome is probably the one that is mentioned the most and that is the most important for decreasing really the bulk of muscle protein. Calpains are very important too. Autophagy is a more complicated pathway. It definitely is involved in muscle protein degradation, but I'll show you why it's more complicated. Apoptosis is something that I like to throw in the mix because I've done a lot of work on it. It also is not easy to think about apoptosis in muscle, and we'll go into that too, why that's kind of a complicated concept. But I tend to think that apoptosis is involved and plays a role. What role it plays, we really don't know yet. But I'd like to show you some more data on this because it's something that usually doesn't get covered, and I'd like to cover it in these lectures. Necrosis is something that hopefully next week will get covered a little bit more because that's really degradation of muscle. So if there's an insult to muscle that causes damage to the muscle and that will need repair, that's when necrosis happens. It usually does not happen during regular muscle atrophy. It can happen during cachexia if you have a really high inflammatory state of the muscle. You can get necrosis. But usually if you talk about muscle atrophy, loss of muscle mass, necrosis is not what we generally talk about, unless you talk about disease states. Muscular dystrophy, so Duchenne muscular dystrophy, all the limb girdles muscular dystrophy, all of that has to deal with necrosis. And hopefully that some of the necrosis part and definitely the regeneration part of that will be covered next week. So the ubiquitin proteasome pathway is really the pathway people talk about the most when they talk about protein degradation. What is this? Ubiquitin is a small protein that gets added to other proteins through a ubiquitin ligase. They call it E1 ligase. Actually, it's an activating protein, these. So you have an activation protein, conjugation step, and then E3s are the ligases. So what happens is that, and this requires ATP, so remember that it requires energy. What happens is you get ubiquitin, becomes activated by these E1 activating proteins. And then the ubiquitin can then go onto the conjugation enzymes. And there are a couple of E1 and E2 enzymes. The E3 is really the one, there are a lot of them, and it's in the hundreds of E3 ligases. They determine specificity to which proteins will get degraded. So these E3 ligases are really important in putting more and more ubiquitins onto a protein such that it gets targeted for degradation. So proteins that have a ubiquitin chain on them, four or more ubiquitins in general, will get targeted to be degraded by the proteasome. And they then become degraded into short peptides. And the short peptides will become degraded by peptidases that are usually free in the cytosol. So these E3 ligases are really what determines what becomes degraded and are also the rate-limiting step. And there are lots of de-ubiquitinating proteins too, so there's a lot of control in this pathway. So these ubiquitins can be released if there's maybe faulty targeting or if degradation shouldn't be as high. So there are de-ubiquitinating proteins in addition to all of the ubiquitin activating proteins, ubiquitin conjugating, and E3 ligases. So what I showed here is what's called the 26S proteasome. The 26S proteasome mainly degrades proteins that are ubiquitinated by this pathway. There's also what's called just the 20S proteasome. And the 20S proteasome degrades oxidized proteins. So proteins that are through oxidative damage are marked for degradation will be degraded by the 20S proteasome. The 26S proteasome is made up of the 20S plus two 19S caps. And the 19S caps recognize the ubiquitinated proteins. And there are three protease activities within this proteasome. So when you read literature on the loss of muscle mass and people have looked at the proteasome, if they do a good job, they usually will look at these three activities because that's really what determines what gets degraded. And I have maybe one or two slides showing you can look at all the different components of the proteasome. You can look at ubiquitin. But what eventually is the important thing is whether the activity of these peptidases, whether that becomes elevated. And there are specific ways in which you can look at that. Okay, so on the slide that you'll get, you can read this. Does this make sense? So these E3 ligases are really important for their rate limiting, and they give specificity to which proteins become ligated and therefore degraded. So this is what I would call a seminal paper in the field of muscle atrophy because it identified two E3 ligases that are muscle specific and very important for muscle degradation. And I don't know if they were mentioned before, if Dr. McCarthy mentioned these, MAFBOX and MERF. Okay, I'll talk about it. So Subudin in the lab of David Glass, when they were both at Regeneron, they're both not at Regeneron anymore, but when they were at Regeneron, they did a differential display. And so what they did, they compared, this was before the time of microarrays. Have we talked about microarrays? I'll talk about microarrays in another slide. But anyway, so what they did is they compared the gene expression of three or four different models of muscle atrophy, Hallam suspension, denervation, starvation, and one other one that escapes me. And then they said, okay, if muscle atrophies, then the genes that are activated in every single model of muscle atrophy should be similar if they're really important. So they compared all of those to control muscles that were not atrophied. And what they came up with was, there's another study from the Goldberg lab that came up with MAFBOX also at the same time, and those papers were published in different journals, but very similar time points. The reason I give this is because they came up with two of them, and I really like that they use three or four different models of atrophy, not just one model, which is the Goldberg lab used only one model, which was starvation. They came up with the same protein, which they called atrogen 1. And so atrogen 1 and MAFBOX, which stands for muscle atrophy FBOX, and the FBOX is part of that, of the protein, are the exact same protein. MERF is a muscle ring finger protein. And so they're different proteins, but they isolated them at that time. And what they showed, and this is important from a hypertrophy versus atrophy standpoint, is they showed that if they had, they then generated the knockout mice. They were at a company that was, you know, they had all the money in the world. They generated the knockout mice for both MERF and MAFBOX. And what they showed is that if you have a control animal, so plus-plus control animal, normal wild-type animal, and you do a denervation. And they showed this also for the other models that they had. You do a denervation. Within 14 days, you get a decrease in muscle size that's substantial. In the MAF box, so the muscle atrophy F-box knockouts, that was VBAT sparing of about close to 60%. So if you don't have these E3 ligases, you don't degrade as much protein. So you can spare that muscle. And that was a little bit less for MERV1, but very similar. The time at which these are expressed is somewhat different within muscle, but they're both expressed highly very early on during atrophy. So what has then, since that time, this was in 2001, many years ago, what has been found since that time, so this is MERV, and this is MathBox. And so you can tell that as proteins, they're very different. They're different proteins. They're both E3 ligases. So they both attach that ubiquitin to that protein at the next step. They ligate those ubiquitin units. They both are involved in inhibiting atrophy. So neural inactivation, unloading, glucocorticoids, inflammatory cytokines, oxidative stress, malnutrition. Like I said, they were isolated because they were involved in all of those pathways. And so indeed, all of those pathways, you've seen FOXO, because that's important in the AKT pathway too, for muscle hypertrophy. It's also important in the pathway for muscle atrophy. And so all of these pathways leads to, these are transcription mediators. So these two are mainly regulated at the transcription level. And so if transcription goes up, protein goes up. I don't know that I've seen a paper in which that's not the case. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. There are very few good antibodies available for MathBox. So we, 5 years from now, I may stand corrected. But in general, these are regulated at the protein transcription level, which is kind of easy because then you can look at just at the RNA, which I find easier. But they are involved in muscle atrophy. Now, what I think is really important is that these animals that had MathBox and MERV knocked out were not bigger. Their muscles were not bigger. So that means that if you knock out things that are involved in atrophy, doesn't mean your muscle necessarily gets bigger. And that, I think, is important to remember. That means that hypertrophy and atrophy are not necessarily exact opposites of one another. And so things you do to hypertrophy, it doesn't mean that that will help in an atrophied person. And I think from a standpoint of athletics versus patients, that's important to remember. So things you do to a normal athlete or a person who you want to gain muscle mass in, who is not atrophied, you may have to do different things than somebody who is atrophied, because they may have all kinds of things ongoing in that muscle that you need to get rid of first, such as an elevation of MathBox. Does that make sense? Because mm-hmm. I think that's an important concept to get when you think about what's going on in the muscle and how you would change how a muscle responds. The same picture again, it just has a lot of stuff on it. So what I want to show here is that AKT, again, is involved in regulating MathBox and MERV. And this mainly goes through FOXO. And you can see myostatin here too, which you talked about last week. So these pathways, so myostatin acts through signaling on FOXO, which is a transcription factor that will increase the levels of MathBox and MERV, which are involved in protein degradation. So the pathways do coincide, but it's not necessarily if one goes up, the other goes up, if one goes down, the other goes up. So cow pains are not talked about all that much, and I myself have not studied them all that much. If you are interested in cow pains, Dr. Jim Tidball has looked at cow pains a lot, maybe mainly in muscular dystrophy. In the muscular dystrophies, people have looked at this more. I'm not quite sure. I think they're really important in muscle atrophy, general disuse atrophy. We just haven't looked at them very much. They're not easy to look at. That's part of it. I could not get my Greek letters to work on my PowerPoint, which I hate, because this is a mu, it's not a u. Okay? So that's mu calpain and m calpain. The reason it's called mu and m is that this... So calpains are activated by calcium. So when calcium goes up in a cell, calpains are activated and start cleaving particular targets in skeletal muscle. And so the active form of calpain is actually this 80 kilodalton, either one of those, for this calpain 3 isoform. As they're heterodimerized with a 30K calpain subunit. And mu calpain is activated by low levels of calcium in the 5 to 50 micromolar range, and M calpain is activated much higher, something 500 to 2500. So mu calpain can be activated when there's small changes in calcium. There is an endogenous inhibitor which is targeted actually in the industry. So if you, let's say you want to decrease muscle degradation, calpains degrade muscle. Well, let's see if we can activate what usually inhibits calpains, which is calpostatin. So calpostatin is an inhibitor of calpains and does get targeted by the industry for drug development. So, what does calpain do? So these are some examples. Sorry, I tend to hit the wrong button once in a while. These are just examples. There's a longer list, but these you will recognize since you've been in this class, I hope. So Titan is an important one. It's a really interesting one. Gets targeted by calpain. But look at troponin, tropomyosin, dystrophin, ankyrin, which is involved in mechanotransduction. So a lot of these somewhat larger quite often and structural proteins are targeted by calpains. And what has been shown in this right now, there is discussion in the literature about this. So this is not something that, again, in 5 years from now or in 10 years from now, I may give a lecture and it will show differently. Because there is some people believe this is true and some people say, no, it isn't. This was out of a recent review, but it may be, reviews are the opinion of the people who write the review, right? Reviews quite often are peer-reviewed, but it is what the opinion of those writers is. So always keep that in mind when you read a big review article. I think that's really important to realize. Anyway, so calpains quite often sit at the Z-line. And there are lots of proteins anchored at the Z-line. When they start cleaving, proteins like pyrin, nebulin, can be released, and that gives you a sarcomere that's unstable. And when you get an unstable sarcomere, it gets targeted for degradation, quite often first by degradation of calpains. There's a limit to the size, and I don't know the exact limit to the size, but there's a limit to the size of what can physically enter the proteasome. And so, quite often, these are the big proteins are cleaved first by calpain and are then targeted to the ubiquitin proteasome pathway by ubiquitination. Also, the proteasome is quite big. So I'm giving you reasons of why people think this happens. The proteasome is quite big. People think that it actually is too big to get in between sarcomeres. So the physical inhibition of space inhibits the proteasome to get into sarcomeres. And that's one of the reasons people say, you know, these big proteins have to be cleaved first, and that's what the scalpanes do. And it's been shown in vitro quite a bit that these scalpanes indeed have these proteins as targets. What I'm not going to mention a lot, but I'll mention it here, is that I'll go into apoptosis in a little bit. But caspase 3 is one. Have you heard of caspase 3? I'll mention it more. But it's also a protease, and it actually targets some of these same proteins. So they get targeted first, they get broken down into smaller pieces, and then they get targeted to be degraded through conversion. So think about how much energy that costs. And it's not cheap for a muscle to atrophy. So there are actually lots of ways in which the muscle tries not to atrophy. And then all the way at the end of my talk, I'll go into that, because I think that's really interesting, if we can utilize that more. And this is kind of showing the same thing. Calcium enters, you get calcium, calpain activation. Myofibrils get broken down into myofilaments. Calpain activation actually also inhibits AKT signaling, which then goes through ubiquitination and 20S proteasome activity to get protein degradation. So a pathway that's, I think, mentioned a lot in muscle atrophy, but we have to be careful about saying it's involved in muscle atrophy, is autophagy. Autophagy definitely degrades protein. So what happens, so autophagy is a pathway in which you get an autophagic zone, which is formed from first an isolation membrane, which then becomes larger, and it starts engulfing cytosolic proteins and organelles. It can engulf whole mitochondria, or pieces of mitochondria. Mitochondria is really, really big, but pieces of mitochondria it can engulf. It can engulf all kinds of things that are in the muscle itself. It then, once it's a full autophagosome, it will lyse with a lysosome, which has the proteases in it, that will then degrade whatever is in the autophagosome. So that was a simple picture. Highly regulated process. Lots and lots of what's called ATGs, which are autophagosome proteins. You can see right here, which is actually Beckman 1, is the same as ATG6. So ATG 12, 16, 5, 5, they are all involved, and 7 and 5 are really important in this early process of elongation of the figure 4 into the figure 7. So all of these proteins are highly regulated and are involved in the process of this of autophagy. And then here you get the lysosome fusing with the autophagosome, and then you get degradation of the protein that's in that autophagosome. But you can see that there's a lot of regulation here. And it's important that it's regulated, because you don't want, when a signal comes into the muscle, this process to just chew up everything. Because that signal may be the wrong signal. It may not always be the right signal. So what you would think is that if you inhibit any of these proteins, let's say you would inhibit ATG5, what I'm going to show you is ATG7 inhibition, that you would inhibit degradation, right? So let's say this degrades protein. So if you inhibit that process, so you don't have ATG7, so you cannot elongate and make another thing, so you would say, okay, that inhibits... right? Seems logical. That would inhibit protein degradation, would inhibit muscle wasting. So what did people do? They developed an ATG knockout mouse. So you knock out ATG7, you're going to inhibit autophagy. So I bet these people were really disappointed when they looked into the cage and saw a small mouse. And so this was done both in embryonic knockout as well as muscle-specific knockouts. I think Dr. McCarthy probably went into that, that you can make mouse in which you can, at an adult age, knock out a certain gene. And so they did both. And what they saw was actually in the knockout mouse, so the FF is the floxed, so when before it's treated, where it still has HG7. And in the knockout mouse, they actually saw a lot of central nucleation, which probably next week we'll talk about more, which is a sign of muscle regeneration. A lot of necrosis, and things that are just not right. They're usually not in the muscle. They then looked at cross-sectional area, and both males and females, the knockout animals, were smaller, muscle size-wise. And estrogen and NRF1 were actually increased. So knocking out this HG7 increased the proteasome pathway, so it actually increased degradation. This was a great paper because they didn't look just at cross-sectional area, and if you want to read it, it's actually a wonderful paper. Because they looked at force, too. And the knockout mice all have lower force, males, females, 2 months of age, 5 months of age. So 2 months, you know, be thinking there may be something going on during embryology, and so autophagy is probably really important at that point in time. So I would not, you know, here I would go, I'm not sure that that's that important. But if they knock it out at 5 months of age and they still see a decrease in muscle force and in muscle mass, then there's a problem. So autophagy is needed for the health of the muscle. So that's really important to remember. Because if you look in an isolated way at autophagy and you say, oh, it goes up with muscle atrophy, so we can inhibit it, so we increase muscle mass, that's not the case. It's biology. Things are more complicated. And I'll show you one picture of what one slide of what we did with autophagy. So I told you I would show all the pathways first, and then I'll just go into some data, which is a lot more interesting. I have no idea how I'm going to do it on time.
You have 25 more minutes.
Oh my God! I need to go fast. Okay. Do you guys need a break?
No.
No? Okay, I don't. Because otherwise I may not get it. So let's go to apoptosis then. I may have to come back next week. Yeah. Because I want to show some cool data. Some of it is old, but I think, but you wouldn't have seen it. Because you wouldn't have read papers from 10 years ago. So apoptosis. Has everybody ever heard of apoptosis? Yeah? You've seen apoptosis pathways, looked at some intracellular apoptosis signaling a little bit. Apoptosis is defined as cell death, as programmed cell death. Because of that reason, it's really weird to think of muscle as programmed cell death. Because what apoptosis does, it attacks the nucleus. You get DNA fragmentation. That's how the cell dies. And how many nuclei does a muscle have?
A lot.
Thank you. Tons. Oodles. So how does apoptosis play a role? And that's I think, why I've never gotten the grant funded on it, because it's a really complicated conceptual issue to think about. If you lose nuclei, what happens to the muscle? Does it even matter? Right? So, we can talk about that for hours. Anyway, so this is, if you've seen apoptosis before, there's what's called the extrinsic apoptosis pathway and the intrinsic apoptosis pathway. The extrinsic apoptosis pathway goes through a death receptor, which activates caspase 8 and then activates caspase 3. So caspase 3 is really pivotal because the intrinsic pathway, which responds to more internal stresses, goes through the mitochondria. You get release of mainly cytochrome C, but there are some other things that are being released also that that then activate caspase 9, which activates caspase 3. What's important, a lot of people always look at caspase 3 and say apoptosis is increased because caspase 3 is increased. There are lots of inhibitors of caspase 3. And in my opinion, you have to show DNA degradation. Because that really is what apoptosis is. It's caspase 3 in muscle gets activated for a number of reasons. It cleaves actin, for example. So it has roles in muscle differentiation. Caspase 3, if you don't have caspase 3, you cannot differentiate a muscle. So it has many more roles, I think in other cell types too, but in muscle in particular. And the last slide I have, last slide, which I may not get to, is giving a little bit of this idea of myotubes versus myoblasm differentiation. This, I think, is really important too, which in a lot of pictures, when you see pictures of apoptosis, they leave this out, the caspase-activated DNAs. So the caspase-activated DNAs, that is what actually cleaves DNA. It gets activated in the cytosol by the cleavage of this inhibitor of that caspase-activated DNAs. Then it translocates to the nucleus, and it cleaves DNA there. I think that's really important. A lot of pictures, I had to look for one where they didn't leave this out, because I think it's really important. And that is showing you that caspase 3 is in the cytosol. It's not necessarily in the nucleus, but that it cleaves this DNA that then gets transported into the nucleus and causes apoptosis. And so this is from a review, actually, from a long time ago, where I've added two proteins that are caspase 3 independent. So here you have caspase 9, which activates caspase 3, which then, I didn't put the CAD in here, but induces apoptosis. But there are proteins that are actually independent of the caspases. And when you talk to people in the apoptosis field, they dismiss them, because they say, they're not important. Once the cell is going to die, it's going to die. Caspases are activated. Everything gets chewed up. They die. Well, that's not what's happening in the muscle. Because the muscle cell doesn't die necessarily. And maybe a nucleus here or there, but not the muscle itself. And so when we looked at apoptosis, we saw elevated apoptosis, and if I get to it, I'll show you that. But we thought, well, maybe it's not just caspase 3, because that indeed has different roles. It may be some of these caspase-independent mechanisms. And these two, AIF and ENDO-G, are released from the mitochondria directly and can act. ENDO-G is an endonuclease, so it directly acts on DNA to cleave it. So like I said, necrosis I don't want to spend a lot of time on because it induces muscle atrophy as a size issue, but it's a very different process. It really is severe damage to the muscle. And so this is putting necrosis against apoptosis. During necrosis, you get usually muscle swelling, membrane breakdown, which you do not get with apoptosis. It's important. So apoptosis does not induce an immune response. Necrosis does, because you get swelling of the membrane, you get release of intracellular proteins, and therefore you get an immune response. Apoptosis does not do that. And so with apoptosis, you get these small apoptotic bodies that then get degraded. What are some reasons for necrotic cell death? ATP depletion, free radicals, increase in intracellular calcium, which also will increase calpains, remember? So calpains are involved in necrosis. And membrane permeability defects, which is why necrosis is very high in muscular dystrophy, because dystrophin is missing, you have membrane instability, and you get necrosis. Does this all make sense? If I'm saying something that doesn't make sense, you know, tell me. Irreversible mitochondrial damage, very high oxidative stress for mitochondria will cause necrosis. So here are the three put together, apoptosis, necrosis, and autophagy. There's a lot of overlap between them in signaling. And if you look at just cell death, so if this is out of kind of a cell death review from a long time ago, there's a continuum between the three. And what you
DNA mapping.
Okay, good question.
So DNA laddering is you can when DNA gets cleaved and you run it on a gel, you can actually see laddering instead of just a smear. And that DNA laddering really is, it gets cleaved in certain units. And so that's just a way to identify apoptosis. Yeah. So when you look at autophagy, which is a cell survival and cell death pathway. So if autophagy gets to a point, here's the point of no return. I kind of like that. If autophagy gets to a point of no return, that cell is going to die. But there is a lot of space here for the cell to survive, because really autophagy is a cell survival pathway. If you are undergoing starvation... So one of the first pictures I've seen of autophagy was from Stefano Schiaffino. And he's an old Italian guy. He's now old. When we did this work, it wasn't very old. But he looked in the diaphragm of lambs really short after they were born and saw a lot of vesicles that he didn't know what they were. And so years later, he described it in a paper, and years later, they were autophagic vesicles. Because the first couple of days after birth, any mammal doesn't get a lot of food unless you start bottle feeding them. But if they are breastfed, so any mammal in a while, doesn't get a lot of food, so they start eating themselves. Autophagy is eat yourself. It's actually a survival mechanism. So the protein you need to survive comes from your own muscle in particular. And that's why you do get muscle degradation with autophagy, but really is a survival path. Does this make sense? So that balance between whether you're surviving or dying, once you get to too much autophagy, there's a point of no return and the cell will die. At that point in time, quite often apoptosis-related mechanisms come into play too. Apoptosis can also be rescued. There are lots of anti-apoptotic pathways, but there's also that point of no return. And you can see at the point of no return, that it goes down. That point goes down, and then the cell's dead. And so necrosis is really a process that comes on much, much later. You have to have a lot more damage. And you can tell autophagy and apoptosis are probably trying to decrease that damage and to fix things before necrosis comes in, and necrosis comes in and say, okay, this cell's gone. There's too much damage. We can't deal with it. I kind of like this because it gives an idea of how there's a balance between, yes, I'm going to die, and no, I'm not going to die. And even though this is very strict for cell death, I think in muscle it plays a big role too, because I think these curves are spread out a lot more in muscle. There's a lot more regulation of all these pathways to actually try to save the cell, because muscle is so important, right? Is muscle one of the most important things? I thought I was going to do this in 40 minutes. Yeah, sorry. Any questions up until this point? I thought we could take a bathroom break here, but if we don't need a break, then... Any questions up until this point? Because I want to go into some data from here on. So what we did a long, long time ago was... and this is where... If we can switch... And I can skip over this if we want to go to another... It's working. Let's see. Those are my kids. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I didn't see the beautiful place. So now my clicker doesn't work. So what I want to show you is some work that we did, and I still like this model because it's such a severe atrophy model. Spinal cord injury at T10. So they're paralyzed, waist down, atrophy in all hyaline muscles. So you get atrophy in everything. What we then did is put them on bicycles. So, see, I wanted to show this video. These bikes are currently in Louisville because I haven't used them since I've been here. We've used them a little bit since I've been here. But you tie their feet to
the motorized, so there's a big motor here. And let me tell you, I spent a lot of hours as a postdoc doing this. Because they were biked half an hour a day, 5 days a week. They gave me, Dr. Peterson, gave me the weekend off. But this was done in coverage for Dr. Boulay, who now is, he's at Drexel. Anyway, so this was a beautiful system to look at what the effect of exercise is on severely, severely atrophied muscle. And so we looked at a lot of different things. Dr. Houlet was in neuroanatomy, and so he was interested actually in spinal, embryonic spinal implants. So what we did is we did implantations into the injury site and exercise and see what we could, how we could rescue the muscle atrophy. And then we looked at a number of different things, but how we could rescue muscle atrophy in these animals. So I should probably switch back, so I won't use this. Yeah. So what we saw was that when you, and like I said, here we can use that. So the book explains a lot more about different muscles undergoing different atrophy at different levels, and so I'm not going to go into that too much. But what we did, soleus in a rat, very heavy type 1 muscle, almost 100% at the age that we used the animals. And it atrophies a lot. So this is your 10 days after spinal cord injury. Atrophies a lot. And you know that. You've seen people with a spinal cord injury. You get severe, severe atrophy. Anything you can do to alleviate that would help. So if you put them on a bike, starting 5 days after the injury, and exercise them for 5 days, you can inhibit that atrophy by quite a bit. If you think about this clinically, that's a lot. To only have half the atrophy.
Do you think what is 5 days in a rat like compared to many people? So I'm just thinking of someone who's like been through a trauma to...
It's a very interesting question because it doesn't scale. So a rat only lives 3 years, so that would mean that it would only be that would be so that it doesn't scale like that because the processes that are underlying this don't scale like that. Now, spinal shock in a human lasts longer than in an animal. So I don't know exactly in a human when, for example, bladder function comes back. In the animals, it takes about 2 weeks before bladder function comes back. So you have to manually express the bladder for about 2 weeks, and then bladder function comes back. In a human, that takes longer. So that's spinal shock. Muscle atrophy occurs in a human and in an animal really, really fast. So I think that if you could, once spinal shock wears off, if you could, people have done this. This has been done in humans. I think as soon as you could get them on there, you could do that. So, but what we were really interested in is what happens in the muscle. So this is before the time that we used a lot of immunohistochemistry. So this is not a picture of immunohistochemistry, but this is a picture of nuclei that are undergoing apoptosis. So this is tunnel staining, is what it's called. It labels nick ends in DNA, which is what apoptosis really does. You get small pieces of DNA, that DNA strands that come up, and you can label that with tunnel. So we get a tremendous amount of tunnel staining in a muscle that has undergone 10 days of spinal cord injury, and then we can inhibit that by biking. So what does that do to the number of nuclei? So what you can see here, and this has progressed over time, we don't know in this picture whether these nuclei are inside or outside the muscle fiber. Really hard to tell. You can't tell from a picture like this. And it was even hard to take these pictures. So what happens then? So at that point in time, it's like, what happens to my nuclear number? Do we get apoptosis in these nuclei inside the muscle, and do we lose, therefore, muscle nuclei? So we looked at that in the soleus and in the plantaris muscles. So the plantaris and the ideal are fiber type wise a lot more similar. Soleus is very heavy type 1, the plantaris is heavy type 2. It's a little slower in the rat than in the mouse. But so in the soleus, we actually lose a lot of fibers. A lot of nuclei. And this is exercise by itself. Exercise by itself didn't do a lot to that. But when we use exercise and an implant, transplantation, we actually got quite a few nuclei back. Okay? Plantaris, flat. No loss of nuclei, no gain of nuclei. And so we actually, this is a picture that Char refers back to once in a while when we talk about nuclear number, the difference between type 1 and type 2 fibers. And you can see that here when you look at cross-sectional area. So is there a correlation then between atrophy and how many nuclei that you have? In the plantaris, there isn't. But in the soleus, there is. So take that for what it's worth. At this point in time, we didn't have a good way to look at whether apoptosis was actually inside the fiber. Later on, we did that, and I'll show you some pictures of that, if I have time. So what we then went to, for a number of different reasons, also because we could reload the animals, we went to Heinlein suspension model. So I've mentioned this before. We suspend the animals by their tail. They're like this for 2 weeks. If you want to see them in real time, you have to come today to the animal facility because we have a couple of them that are still hanging, but that'll go down today. So, talk to me. Is that what you said? No. Don't. Yeah. They're a little sad. So, what we have is, it's called tail suspension or Heinlein suspension. They're unloaded. It's very similar to what happens during bed rest and space flight. You have no gravity loading on the muscle. Of course, in bed rest, you have some gravity loading, but you're not loading the muscles. Nervous system is intact. So if you really want to look at intact response as well, these legs are moving around. There's EMG activity. And so the book goes into that quite a bit too, whether this should be called disuse or decreased use. Because they're using their muscles, but they're not loaded. And so they atrophy. And these are just some... We looked at different ages because I'm really interested in age-related loss of muscle mass and the inhibition with reloading. And we usually do a 14-day, 7 or a 14-day Heinlein suspension. One of the interventions that we did is called flywheel exercise. So anybody ever heard of flywheel exercise? Can you explain what it is?
It seems to be inertia-based.
Right. So it's like a yo-yo. So when you throw a yo-yo down, the energy that you get from the loading and the gravity loading that is stored in that yo-yo, and that's why it comes back up. Right? You can throw a yo-yo down, come back up. So you can do this in space without gravity, because if you as a person puts energy into that spring, then the spring will pull you back. And so you can exercise. And if you tell a human, because the eccentric phase of that exercise is more important, if you tell a human, try to resist it when it pulls you back, you actually get a really nice response. So this flywheel technology is actually used by the European Space Agency in space. So what we try to mimic that. There's a number of issues with it, but I'll show you just a little bit of what we did. So it's hard to see this picture. You may want to go to the paper. Flucky is first author. I'm last author of this paper. But what we did is we trained the animals while they were still loaded to push a button, and then they would come down. And that's a way to actually exercise mainly their gastroc. So they would come up, push a button, come down, come up, push a button, come down. We would then Heinlein suspend them, and now the button up there is actually down here. And so now they have to go and push the button there. Unfortunately, you cannot tell a rat, resist when you go back. But you can do that. We did it, but they didn't listen. So, but what happens is that the flywheel does pull them back. We didn't get the really nice response we wanted that we thought we could get, but we got a response. So during the six sessions that they do every other day for so three times a week, two sets of 25 for 2 weeks, so that's six sessions, they did increase in strength. So we measured their force because we could measure the force on the flywheel, the force that they were pulling with. So they did increase in strength for all that's worth. It could, we talked about a lot of ways how we could make this better, but then Dr. Flucky moved to Texas A&M. So we did get, see, this is with Heinlein suspension, decrease in soleus, also a huge decrease in muscle size. And so this is muscle mass to body mass ratio. We did get a slight increase with that resistance training. So this, like I said, this is actually something that's used in space to look at. So we did not see anything with apoptosis. When we looked at tunnel positive nuclei, they were the same. They increased with Heinlein suspension. They were the same with resistance training. I think the increase in mass that we got was just too small to see anything with apoptosis. Or the resistance exercise that we used doesn't decrease that apoptosis, but actually may increase it, like you see here. So apoptotic index was measured when we ground up to whole tissue, and there's an assay that you can use to measure DNA fragmentation. In a different kind of assay. So we've quite often used both these assays. Tim, are you keeping time? Are you cutting me off when
I missed the 5 minute mark of time slot.
Okay. So I won't get through all my slides. So maybe I can ask Kevin to come back on Monday. I was planning on coming on Monday.
Yeah.
I'll be here on Monday. But so we did look at protein synthesis. So we looked at 5 minutes.
You have
1 minute.
You have 1 minute?
Yeah, we want
I missed the 5 minutes.
Yeah, I didn't have the mark
for 1 minute.
Okay, so what we did in this model, which was really interesting, so this is very similar actually to what happens in our massage animals, Tim. But so we looked at phenylalanine incorporation, which is you can look at that to see if protein synthesis is increased. So you look at radio-labeled phenylalanine. And we did that in an isolated muscle. We're doing it now, I think, much fancier in the whole body with deuterium, but it's a whole different issue. So what we saw was that there was a decrease in the incorporation of this amino acid into muscle in a muscle that had been Heinlein suspended. But we completely reversed that with the resistance training. And this is very similar to what happens in our massage animals, actually, that we can, the protein synthesis we can get up by quite a bit. The muscle we cannot. So that's an interesting issue. Now, what was interesting, too, is when we looked at ubiquitin, can we talk about ubiquitin? Matbox and MERV, they were actually reversed. So they went up quite high with Heinlein suspension, and then with resistance exercise, they were reversed, and so we could actually block degradation by that resistance exercise. Okay, so I think I need to stop here because this goes into a different model. Sorry I didn't get through this. I thought I was...
Okay.
I'm at the neuroscience meeting on Monday. I'll be here.